This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, it may not surprise you to know that most politicians are wealthy, but politicians insist that they are still able to represent the needs and values of all of their constituents. A Duke professor is questioning that assertion. Nick Carnes has written a book called White Collar Government, The Hidden Role of Class in Economic Policymaking. And he says that the class of our leaders has a huge impact on whose interests they represent. Nick Carnes is an assistant professor of public policy at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University and joins us now. Nick, welcome. Good to have you here.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Frank.
Let's start with some of the statistics. We're not really talking, we're talking about wealth, but also wealth as it relates to class and the kind of work that you've done as a politician. So people in public policy tend to be white-collar workers, mostly.
Absolutely. You know, working-class people, people who do manual labor jobs, service industry jobs, they make up a majority of our country, but what I find when I look at the data is that they don't make it into political office at any level of government. If working class people were a political party, they would be, you know, half of the electorate, but less than 2% of Congress. And the opposite is true for millionaires. If millionaires were a political party, they would be about 3% of the country, but they would have a majority in the House, a supermajority in the Senate, 5-4 on the Supreme Court, and a man in the White House. And to me, that kind of disconnect between the people and their elected representatives raises some pretty serious questions about the health of our democracy.
Well, there are some disconnections in a number of areas. First of all, it's your own experience. It's what you've done in your life, right, as in terms of work experience. So talk a little bit about that and what you found statistically in terms of how those kinds of work experiences are represented in Congress.
Absolutely. So I think one of the first questions we have to ask when we see just this economic gulf between politicians and the people, one of the first questions we have to ask is, does that actually matter? Do politicians from different classes who have different sort of work experiences before they get into office, do they actually make different kinds of choices in office? And so what I do in White Collar Government is I've tried to pull together every source of systematic data I could find on the occupational or social class backgrounds of politicians at every level of government in the United States, members of Congress, state legislators, down to city council members. And I've asked, when working class people are absent, do policymakers make different decisions, or do politicians who don't have experience in the working class make different decisions? And the really striking thing to me is that I find the same pattern at every period in U.S. history, in every stage of the legislative process, at every level of government. When you don't have people with real experience in the working class in your legislature, you get different economic policy. You get policy that's less pro-worker, more pro-business. And that has real consequences for who wins and who loses.
Are there differences in the disparities at different levels, local, state, federal? Or does the disparity gap change much?
Well, so local governments have a little bit less discretion than, say, Congress. You know, they're working with tighter budgets. They have a harder time sort of borrowing money. And so they have a little bit less leeway when it comes to setting economic policy. But the basic pattern is always the same. When you exclude working class people from your political institutions, you get economic policy that's better for the rich and that's less in line with what working people want.
Well, and again, that's pretty subjective, right? Because if you're in office and you voted for that policy that you have called better for the rich and not so good for the working class, I'm guessing that in fact, you talk about it in the book, that when you're in office, you're saying, oh, no, this is really good for everybody. This policy that appears to help only wealthy people, tax cuts for the rich in North Carolina or something, that by giving them that money, it's going to be good for all of us.
Right. You know, we can always have debates about, you know, whether conservative economic policies are really good for the poor because the money trickles down or something like that. What I do in the book is I sort of ask, what do different classes of Americans actually want? And you know, we can sit here all day and argue about whether raising the minimum wage would be good for working people. But what we know is working class people are a lot more likely to say raise the minimum wage. white-collar professionals, business owners, are a lot less likely to say we should raise the minimum wage. And when you've got a government that's made up entirely of white-collar professionals, it's a lot harder to do something like increasing the minimum wage. I mean, even economists can debate, you know, the effects of economic policy. But what we know is working people really do want more progressive economic outcomes than wealthier people. And when you take working people out of your political institutions the way we have, you get more conservative policies.
And why is that? Is it simply because it's more expensive to run a campaign?
Well, so that's the big question right now is what exactly is keeping working class people out of our political institutions? You know, if it's so important that they aren't there, why aren't they there in the first place? And that's sort of an area where the research is still kind of in the early stages, to be honest. Political scientists haven't pinned down. There's no smoking gun yet that says this is exactly the factor that's keeping working class people out of office. There are a couple of things that we can take off the table, I think, though. So one argument that you often hear is voters, you know, this is a democracy. And if we're governed by rich people, that means voters want to be governed by rich people. And when you actually look at the data, that turns out not to be the case. When working class candidates run, they tend to do about as well as other candidates. What's really happening is voters almost never get the opportunity to vote for a working class person. So if you look at your ballot, if you actually go through and find out what the people on your ballot did for a living, you'll quickly see that you almost never get the option to vote for someone with real experience in the working class. So it's not the case that, you know, voters are saying we want to be governed by the rich. It's voters don't have any choice. By the time they get to the polls, it's, you know, millionaire lawyer or millionaire business owner.
So that suggests not so much that your personal wealth has an influence on whether how high you get, you know, through the process. It's an expensive campaign. I got a lot of money. I can afford it. It does suggest, however, that the selection process, the selectors are looking for people like them to put on the ballot. And when they see people like them, they're more likely to get through the filters than working class folk.
Yeah, that's really my hunch, Frank. We know that there are lots of working class people out there who have sort of the qualifications, the things you might want in a political candidate or in a political leader, but they're not being recruited at the same rates as other potential candidates. And my hunch is that might have something to do with the fact that, you know, if you're a party leader, if you're, you know, an interest group and you're trying to encourage someone to run for office, it's hard to do that kind of work. It's hard to find people to run for office. And you know, if you're a lawyer and let's say, you know, you're the chair of the, you know, Orange County Republican Party, you're not going to do a survey of everyone in Orange County and you know, find, you know, randomly sample from that. You're going to say, well, who do I know who's a Republican who could run for office? And you know, if you're a lawyer, you're probably going to know a lot of other attorneys.
And you have the time to be active in politics. You have the time to show up and you have the money to donate to campaigns, which brings you to the attention of one party or the other.
I think that's a big part of the explanation, too. Yeah, the other side of this is if you're a blue-collar worker, not only are you not being encouraged to run, but just the practical barriers to running for office are going to be even more of a burden. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is it's incredibly hard for anybody to run for political office. Even, you know, a rich lawyer is going to have, I mean, it's just an extremely challenging job. It requires enormous personal sacrifice. But those barriers are going to, I think, disproportionately screen out people who are already starting from a position where they don't have a lot of free time, they don't have a lot of free resources.
What your research suggests, too, is it doesn't much matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. You're probably not representing the working folk like the Democratic Party used to at one time represent.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about the differences between politicians from different classes is that it's not just a Republican phenomenon or Democratic phenomenon. Politicians from both parties are disproportionately wealthy. Neither party has, you know, any working class politicians, or neither party has, you know, very many working class politicians getting into office. And the differences are basically the same within the Republican Party. A Republican who was a CEO and a Republican who was a blue-collar worker are going to look different in basically the same way that a Democrat who was a CEO and a Democrat who was a worker would look different. One of the examples I often point to is Orrin Hatch, a senator from Utah. He's a, you know, Republican senator from the most conservative state in the country. You know, he should be the most conservative member of the Senate, but you see him throughout his career, you know, every now and again, he'll you know, break with his party and he'll vote for, you know, some bill to expand access to health care. You know, he'll get up on stage with Ted Kennedy and shake hands and take pictures. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that before Orrin Hatch was a senator and before he was a lawyer, he was a janitor and he was a security guard. And this is somebody who understands what it's like not to have health insurance. And
we should point out he's been there a long, long time. Unlikely for that trajectory to result in success again. Right? I mean, for a guy who started as a janitor and security guard, he's been there for decades.
So I think your sense is right that it's getting even harder. You know, a story like that is getting even more unlikely as elections become more expensive. For the book, I interviewed a former House member from Rhode Island, Edward Beard, and Beard ran for office in the 1960s, and he had a campaign budget of the equivalent of about $900 today. It was literally a shoestring budget. He spent most of that money replacing his shoes because he was walking door to door in his district telling people about his background and his views. He was a house painter. He ran this. He was truly a blue-collar worker. He got elected to the U.S. House. It was a stunning upset. And I interviewed him for the book, and I said, "You were a house painter, and you quit your house painting job to go to the U.S. House. Could you do that today?" And he said, "Absolutely not. It was incredibly hard back then when campaigns were cheap. Today, it's even harder now that running for Congress is such an expensive operation."
One of the interesting findings that you have developed is the fact, it seems, that blue-collar workers, when they get in there, people from working class who are in public office, tend to work harder at building coalitions for their legislation.
Yeah, so one of the things I do in white-collar government is I look at how hard politicians work to pass different kinds of legislation. And on domestic economic bills, on sort of bread-and-butter economic policy, politicians from the working class work twice as hard or build coalitions twice as big. They get twice as many co-sponsors to support their economic proposals as politicians from white-collar backgrounds. So they really are, you know, working twice as hard on the issues that most Americans really care about.
You know, and I know this goes beyond the scope of your book, but if you think about that, the idea that if you work harder to build a broader coalition before you bring it to a final vote, you might have more support. It may point to this larger question of why the polarization in our political process and why we don't have as stable a system, legislation under assault the moment it is signed, versus a time when people really had broad support for their legislation.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that, you know, Congress is becoming more polarized, potentially more polarized than it's ever been. And you know, what I show in the book is that working class politicians are building bigger, broader coalitions to try to pass economic policies, common sense economic reforms that Americans really care about. You know, I can't say what Congress would look like if it were 50%, you know, people from the working class, because it's never had that many people from the working class in it.
So we talked about some of the barriers and why it may be difficult for kind of working folk to make their way into office these days. But why do we tolerate it? It seems to me that if all of those politicians who boast about common sense don't have common experience, at some point there's going to be a coalition, a kind of a revolt, and that the numbers would simply overturn this oligarchy that seems to be running things these days.
Well, I don't know what the prospects for revolt are, Frank, but I do see a lot of interest in changing this feature of our political process. So in New Jersey, the AFL-CIO has run a candidate school since the 1990s, actually, where they've identified, recruited, and trained working class people in New Jersey to run for every kind of office from, you know, school board up to state legislature. And the program's been really successful. It runs on, you know, a small operating budget in sort of New Jersey political standards. But the graduates of the school have a 75% win rate. They've won close to 800 elections. The model is now being sort of picked up in a half dozen other states and sort of tried out. And so, you know, to me, that says that actually there's a lot of potential for programs that could change, you know, the makeup of our political institutions, programs that would encourage working class people to run for office tend to do really well when people with power and resources get behind them.
And organization. So is there a correlation between the decline of the unions and decline of representation of working class? Because there was an organization and somebody who could actually create an education program.
You know, even back when unions were strong, there were very few working class people getting into political office. You know, go back a half century, unions are a lot stronger than they are today. Congress is still less than 2% working class at that point. So it's really only recently that unions have started, just in the last few years, getting serious again about recruiting blue-collar workers to run for political office. So this is actually a relatively new strategy for organized labor, but I think it's one that has a ton of potential.
Any other evidence at the grassroots level that things are changing?
You know, when I talk to people about this, there seems to be a lot of interest in the factors that are keeping working class people out. The thing that I often find, so when I talk to, say, party officials, they often tell me, we would love to run working class candidates. We just don't know very many people who fit the bill. So I think there's a lot of potential. Voters like working class candidates. Party officials often tell me they would like to run work candidates who have real experience in working class jobs. I think it's you know, it's something that could really take off in the next few years.
Nick, pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank.
Nick Carnes, assistant professor of public policy at Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke and author of White Collar Government: The Hidden Role of Class in Economic Policymaking. For more information, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. That's our program for today. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley's our technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.